Dr. Rodriguez, can you tell me about the first time you met Richard Lee Norris, the patient who had a full face transplant in 2012?
Sure. The first time we met was in 2005. I had received an inquiry from his mother to see if I would be willing to take on his case. She mentioned a little bit of the type of injury that he had sustained, the types of procedures, and asked if I would be willing to take on his case. I informed the mother that, of course, they were welcome to come and see me at my clinic hours, but it was difficult for them to drive up during the week, so they asked if I would be willing to see them on a weekend, and sure enough, I did. I saw them on a Saturday morning. And the first time I met him, he came in wearing a baseball cap, as he traditionally did for a number of years, a surgical mask to cover his face. All you could see was essentially his eyes. And he came in, I believe he came in with a close friend of his mother, could not come. And as most of these patients present themselves, they're usually not very talkative. They have some concerns that they want to have addressed. And specifically with Richard's case, he had reached some point of fatigue with the teams that had been taking care of him, and he described it as Band-Aid operations. He was looking for a bigger fix.
Yeah, and his original injury was from a gunshot wound to the face, right?
That's correct. A self-inflicted shotgun injury, accidental shotgun injury in 1997. And he was initially treated in his the local area. He comes from Virginia, and he was treated at one of the main institutions in North Carolina, and then had a number of procedures there, and then had a number of additional procedures in Virginia. And that's when they reached the end of the road and they got to me.
So what did he look like once he took off his mask?
He was missing his nose, did not have any upper and lower lips. The opening of his mouth aperture was very constricted, almost like the size of a belly button. He could barely speak. He had limited amount of movement of his tongue. His speech was somewhat intelligible, did not have any bony support to the midface, and did not have any bony support to the lower jaw. So he had a very, very small face compared to what you would consider a normal appearing face.
Now, obviously, the face is absolutely crucial to our life and to how we interact with other people, how we are seen by other people. How did Richard's disfigurement affect his life up until then?
Well, I think like most of these patients, they undergo an injury, then they just want to get fixed up and get back to their normal lives as they saw it before their injury. But what Richard realized that life that he knew was pretty much gone. As he attempted to try to go back to his routine daily doings, what he found was that people were staring at him. And then he tried to conceal what it was that people were staring at. So he covered himself with a mask. And even with the mask, what he found was that more people were interested in what was behind the mask. So then he went on to conceal himself from society as much as possible, avoiding daily social interaction. And it became very difficult for him. He wore almost like a ski mask that people wear in high-altitude skiing to keep their face warm, that goes over their nose and their mouth. And on a number of occasions, he walked into convenience stores. And at the convenience stores, they felt that it was a heist. The police department would be called. And he went through this a couple of times, and he was incredibly embarrassed. And that's why he really almost became a recluse, avoided social interaction as much as possible. His life, as he knew it, had dramatically changed. And despite all the surgical procedures that he had performed, he would look at pictures of him before the injury, and he realized that he wasn't anywhere near that appearance that he had before his injury.
Right. So 7 years later, after
Correct.
That first meeting with him, you and a team of doctors performed a marathon face transplant operation. What did you do?
So we spent a number of years working on him, and obviously we weren't getting to the level of appearance and function that he desired. And he had asked about facial transplantation for a while. Keep in mind, the first face transplant occurred in 2005.
And only and something like what? Only 30 have been done around the world to this date. I mean, this is not a common operation by any means.
That is correct. And when Richard was asking, we were probably in the number of the teens. There really wasn't a tremendous amount of foundation and research. We didn't really understand how long these face transplants would last, what the type of medication, the amount of medication that would be required, what was the longevity. There were so many questions. But we reached a point with our team that we really understood the medications that would be required to keep these grafts alive. We understood anatomically what would be required for Richard to not only look normal, but to function normal. And that meant speaking and eating as normal as possible. And after going through all this regulatory process, Richard was elected as the patient, and we listed him. And the goal was to have Richard, and what he always requested, he just wanted to be an average person. He wanted to walk in a room and not have anybody stare at him anymore. And that's what we set out to do. And it was a big challenge because until that point, there had been a number of transplants that have occurred. The majority were soft tissue, face transplants, some inclusion of bony segments, but it wasn't the majority. And we wanted to give him teeth. He didn't have teeth for 15 years. He needed a portion of his tongue. So all these complement of tissues, the full face with the eyelids, the nose, the lips, skin of the hair, the skin of the neck, and then you put all the bones of the upper jaw, the lower jaw, the upper teeth, lower teeth, and the tongue. Nothing of this magnitude had ever been performed.
I mean, this is astonishing what you're saying. I mean, you're saying you didn't just give him a new face. I mean, you reconstructed the infrastructure of his face. I mean, you gave him new teeth. You built his tongue. You created his upper and lower jaw, portions of his eyelids. I mean, this is astonishing.
That's absolutely correct. And that was a principle that we had always used in standard facial reconstruction. If you want to restore someone to normal, you have to sometimes recreate the defect and then build the architecture so that it's a normal anatomical skeletal tissue with the appropriate soft tissue support. And that, at times, requires going back to the demolished state and building from new. And it's a concern because in a lot of face transplants, keep in mind, you have to remove what you feel is not normal to put on a face transplant. Also keep in mind that if this were to fail, the patient would likely be much worse off than he was prior to the surgery. So this is high-stakes surgery.
Yeah.
And that's why you have to work with patients that really understand the magnitude, not only of the surgical procedure, but of the potential loss and failure.
And so not only did you have your patient here, I mean, you also need a donor face as well, right? I mean, how does that work?
So once you list a patient, you have a patient basically on the ready. He's on call 24/7, the same as we are. We work with an organ procurement organization that is identifying patients that meet our specific criteria. And that criteria is defined by blood type, HLA type. We try to look at specific markers within the blood that will match the recipient as close as possible to limit the amount of rejection. Keep in mind, all patients will have rejection. Now, rejection is a very strong word, but it's a universally accepted phenomenon for all patients that have this type of procedure. And commonly, rejection can be contained with the proper medication regimens.
So in other words, when you're having this operation with sort of, you know, all this new tissue is being added to your body, I mean, your body's natural reaction is to reject a lot of it, and somehow you have to give the appropriate drugs so that your body won't just reject it all.
That's exactly right, because these are individuals that are genetically mismatched, that have totally different DNA, and the common response is to fight it as non-self. With the immune suppressive medication, you can control that attack and keep that contained. So we know that all patients will have acute rejection episodes, but we try to control that as much as possible by matching these patients as close to possible as we can. So that involves blood work. Then on top of the blood work, we try to look for patients that have similar characteristics. That means the color of their skin, the dimensions of their skeleton. We even try to match the color of their hair and their eyebrows so that we can blend everything in to their face ideally to the way that they were before their injured state. That's the goal.
Does the face of the donor have to resemble the face of the person who's going to get the new face?
That's a great question. It doesn't necessarily have to. So when you look at our patient and our donor, there are very strong resemblances because their skeleton is somewhat, the facial skeleton is similar. The color of their hair, their eyebrows was similar. However, there are slight differences within individuals. But what we have found, and this has already been proven and published, when you take a donor face and you put it on the recipient, it never looks entirely like the donor. It never looks entirely like what the recipient was before. And it's a very unique blend of both individuals because the face of the donor redrapes or reforms to its new recipient position. So some of the remaining skeletal morphometry or skeletal components of the face of the recipient adapt themselves to the donor face.
So take me to the day of the surgery. I mean, this surgery, which lasted how long? I mean, how many hours?
We worked for approximately 36 hours.
36 hours for this one surgery?
For this one surgery.
Wow.
It's a lengthy procedure, but the way it happens, we had identified the donor. We notified Richard. Richard got flown up from Virginia. Everything was set to go Monday morning, so we began our surgical procedure at 4:30 in the morning. You also need to keep in mind that in addition to this individual and this generous family donating the face, they also donated other organs. So in addition to the face, six other organs were being transplanted from this single individual on these couple of days that we worked for.
Wow.
We begin the operation at 4:30 in the morning. And commonly, my facial team, which I led in the donor, works on procuring the donor face. And we
So there are two simultaneous teams working together. I mean, you're working with the person, in this case, Richard, who's going to get the face. And then there's a whole different team of surgeons working
right.
with the donor.
That is correct. So we have an elite team of surgeons, individuals that I personally trained, where we've practiced this operation on cadavers, and we simulate this exact operation 15 times before we actually do this. So we know exactly what step to do. Everything is timed and rehearsed to the T so that we can predictably move forward and define periods of reversibility. Keep in mind, you're working on a donor that may have instability, and there are times that we may have to abort the case. So we have to sequence the removal of the recipient face within a timeline of the procurement of the donor face. Because if we have to abort the donor procedure, we have to ensure that the recipient face has not been removed in entirety and the patient can get out of the operating room safely. So everything is sequenced. And exactly as you mentioned, two rooms are working together. The recipient operation and the donor operation are occurring in a sequenced fashion. So once the donor face has been carefully dissected and we have to remove everything very carefully, we have to identify the nerves that will move the face, the nerves that will provide sensation to that face, define the muscles, make precise skeletal cuts on the jaws of the face and the jaws of the lower jaw so that it fits the recipient face perfectly. Once we finish that donor dissection, at that point, we've reached a point of essentially irreversibility, the point of no return, where we actually remove the face of the recipient, the face that he, in Richard's case, had lived with for 15 years.
You just peel off his face, and he's just there without any face at all, waiting for the new face to be put on.
Right. So essentially, his forehead, the bone of the forehead, the frontal bone is exposed. The eyes are exposed, and we removed everything in the face. So there's no nose. We're looking at the back of the throat. There is no upper jaw. There are no teeth. We're looking at the base of his tongue, and everything is prepared to accept this new face, which is coming with all the tissues, the skin, the muscles, the underlying fat, the nerves, the tongue, the teeth. Everything has to fit just like a puzzle.
What was the hardest part of the surgery?
I don't know that there was any major complexity. There are challenging points, but for me, I think the point of no return where I knew I removed Richard's face and the possibility of death existed. However, when a patient's asleep, death is not a big problem. Death is a greater problem for the loved ones that you leave behind. But for me, the biggest concern was the potential consequence if this face were to fail, that I knew that I'd, at this point, had made Richard worse than he was before he entered that operating room. And the likelihood of a difficult course following failure of his face would be tremendous. Keep in mind, these patients receive medications so they don't mount a normal immunological response to the new face. So we've incapacitated an individual at a cellular level to be able to handle a major infectious episode. So when your face, the facial allograft doesn't take or it doesn't work, now we're looking at a pretty sizable wound in the face. And although we can temporarily cover it and care for it, it's a difficult problem to be facing.
What did you think your odds of success were going into this surgery?
I always told Richard and I told my team, and I go, despite everything that we trained, despite everything that we have spent hours to work on to succeed, the possibility of failure is limitless. So I gave Richard a 50-50 chance of this working. And I wanted to make sure that he and his family had complete clarity that this had never been performed in the history of medicine, and that the risk was tremendous.
So how did it go?
Thank God, perfect. But I'll tell you. I'll tell you, everything is exhilarating. It's a race. And people ask me, how did I work for 36 hours? You know, when you have this responsibility, when you have, you know, I'm essentially the coach of this team, that we have to accomplish this mission. Once we connected the blood vessels and we see this face that was white sitting in a cooler become pink, you could almost hear everyone in the operating room cheering. But keep in mind, now this face is becoming perfused, but we still have another 18 hours of work to do. And keep in mind, we have a patient in the operating room that we got to get out of there safely. So the technical aspects of the operation are coming together beautifully, but we don't know when the first episode of acute rejection is going to hit. We don't know what the circumstances of an individual being under a general anesthetic for 36 hours will be. Will this patient wake up normally? Could the patient have a stroke in the operating room? Luckily, Richard is strong, healthy, and young, and we feel pretty confident that he can overcome this. So we connect all the blood vessels, the face pinks up, stabilize the skeleton, we fix the teeth, we fix the jaws, we put all the hardware, all the screws, all the plates, we reconstruct the internal lining of his mouth, we suture the palate, put the tongue together, connect all the nerves, and we get him out to the recovery room. Another set of accomplishments. We made it out. The patient's alive. He's hemodynamically stable. Now we got to wait for him to wake up.
Did you get any...
Is he going to...
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'll...
Do I get any sleep?
Yeah. Let me ask the question.
Sure.
Did you get any sleep during this whole procedure?
No. You can't sleep. It goes pretty quickly, actually. You know, when you have all these things that you need to accomplish. Now, there are breaks. So our team, we set it up that we can get a cup of coffee, eat half a sandwich. But the amount of adrenaline and epinephrine flowing through your blood vessels to get this kid out of the room is incredible. So that's all you're thinking about. Finish the task at hand. Now, we've prepared. We've done this so many times in rehearsals that we can essentially do this operation in our sleep. And I've trained our entire team so that we can all be interchangeable if we're... Because things happen. We have family responsibilities or traveling out of the country. So we have to be able to do this procedure with whatever number of individuals will be there for that day. Because once you identify the perfect match. Now, finding a perfect match in Richard's case meant he had a 14% chance of finding an individual that would fit him perfectly. So once you find that individual, there's no turning back. We move forward with whatever we have.
Yeah.
So, because you can't let them.
Yeah. So here you were. You'd spent over 30 hours in the operating room, and you know, Richard had a new face at that point, and then you're waiting for him to wake up.
Right. So the next major milestone is watching Richard wake up. So now I'm feeling pretty good. But now the big hurdle for me, although I know he looks great, and everything went technically beautifully. Now the biggest challenge for me, when he asked me for a mirror, is that going to be what he expected? In other words, I know that he looks great. I know that he looks normal. But when he looks in the mirror, is he going to see himself as normal? What's going to be the response? So on the second day when he was more awake and he was sitting in the comfortable bedside chair so he can relax, a little more comfortable sitting up, I wanted to make sure that his family was there, his mother, his father, his brother, sister, all his loved ones. When I gave him the mirror, he wanted to look. He desperately wanted to look. And the moment he looked, I will tell you, there was not a dry eye in that room. He just stared, and he touched his lips because he hadn't had lips in 15 years. And he just looked at me and hugged me and thanked me. It was a pretty emotional moment.
Oh, I can imagine. Wow. But he couldn't smile, right? I mean, it takes actually years to develop the ability to smile.
Now, the interesting thing, nerves, because we have nerves in a face transplant that are exposed to immune suppressive medication, the recovery time is a lot faster than you would expect in nerves that are connected without immune suppression. So we expected recovery time on him to be fast. And sure enough, his recovery time from a sensory standpoint and from a functional motor standpoint was impressive. It was amazing. We actually biopsy the tissue every week to make sure there are no signs of rejection. And very early on, I couldn't biopsy him without local anesthetic because it bothered him. And there were times that if he didn't shave, because I didn't want him to shave to irritate his face. I remember the first day he told me that. He goes, "Dr. Rodriguez, I really want to shave because I hate when my hair grows long underneath my neck and it itches." And I took a moment to think about this, and I went, "My God, you know, he has sensation in his skin from the facial hair growth." And he could smell, finally.
He couldn't smell for all those years?
He could not smell for 15 years.
Wow.
And he was walking outside. We would take him for routine physical therapy walks outside of the hospital. Keep in mind, we kept him in the hospital for over 2 months just to make sure we could monitor everything carefully. And he's walking outside, and they're mowing the lawn in the hospital grounds. And he just pauses, and he's looking at this lawnmower, and he's smelling fresh-cut grass. And he goes, "God, I haven't smelled that in so long." So all these things are so emotional. You know, drinking for the first time, he's having this tomato-based soup, and he's just enjoying the taste of tomatoes and this soup that he hadn't enjoyed anything like that. All these things that we take for granted, every discovery for him was just an incredible milestone, and it was wonderful to watch all of that happen before us.
It's almost as if he was rediscovering what it meant to be alive again.
That's right. And also for us, we don't know what's the response going to be. Because this face, while we were preparing him, sat in a cold preservative for 3 hours. So we don't know, are we going to have a normal response? Are the nerves going to function as normal as we would expect? Is this tongue going to move with the base of his tongue? So all these are questions that remain unanswered. And sure enough, as he continues to heal and convalesce, everything is coming back to life and evolving. And now when we fast forward the clock and you look at him now, I think for me the greatest accomplishment, and I think for all of us, is to see this individual who came into our clinic in 2005, concealing his face, not wanting to talk, that now he will walk into a room full of people and he will put his face right up against yours and talk to you as if he were just another average person. Really a remarkable accomplishment to see what has gone, what he's undergone through from a psychological standpoint, from a self-esteem and confidence standpoint is just amazing.
I mean, what you're describing is not just a dramatic change of personality. You're almost talking about a new sense of self. I mean, it's as if Richard has become a new person, a different person.
That's exactly right. It's as if we reached a fork in the road and we told him, okay, we're just going to change the trajectory of where your life is going and we're going to push you down this way and this is the person you're going to be. And that's exactly right. He's a totally different individual.
So what's his life like now?
He continues to live in Hillsville, Virginia, where he's going to school, he's going to college. He wants to get a degree. I think he wants to focus on information technology and computers. He goes around speaking. He's very much involved in supporting wounded warriors and really sharing his story with people that have severe disfigurement, giving them hope not to give up, that there is an opportunity out there for individuals that have an uncorrectable facial injury, that we're working on it. He really is very much focused on caring for the wounded veteran. And he always was. I even remember on the day of the surgery, when I sat there with him, his mom, myself, and him, his mom said a prayer, and we prayed together. And I said, Richard, if you want right now, we end this operation. We don't move forward. I just want to make sure that you understand that we'll stop everything. It doesn't really matter. And he said, no, you know, I want to do this for the soldiers. And I told him, well, that's great, but we need to focus on yourself. And he goes, no, I know it's going to go well, but once we solve this problem, I think the soldiers will see that we can help them. And he's always been that way, still to today. So it's great. He goes to Walter Reed and he meets with the veterans and meets with soldiers and lets them know, you know, I'm doing great. Everything is coming along. He's very good that way. He's an incredible individual.
Yeah. Well, I've seen pictures of Richard, you know, before and after. I mean, even, you know, before he had the accident, then after the accident, and his face really is just totally disfigured. And then now, and I mean, they truly are astonishing. I mean, it's just the transformation is just amazing. It does raise the question of how much all of this costs.
Correct. So I think the average cost, as we predicted when I was in Baltimore, it was about $500,000. And now we've put together a business plan here at NYU. And I think the remarkable thing at the NYU Langone Medical Center, I think we've really put together a pretty well-organized business plan that is all-encompassing and covers the care of an individual at every level, even if they require revisionary procedures or corrections, medications. And even for New York standards, I thought it was going to be a lot more. So we're talking in New York about $500,000 as well.
So did Richard's, did Richard's family foot the bill?
No. In Richard's case, this was part of the Department of Defense grant through the Office of Naval Research. And still today, the Department of Defense, through a number of different granting mechanisms, is still supporting a lot of these projects and key centers throughout the U.S. to restore not only the wounded soldier, but also civilians with severe facial disfigurement to normalcy. So they're supporting a lot of the research and a lot of the clinical trials moving forward. But the goal is for this type of work to transition someday to be standard of care so that select individuals at select centers can have this type of operation. This is not a surgical procedure for everyone.
Yeah. Now, I've heard that there have been more face transplants in Europe, partly because, I guess, health insurance plans actually have covered many of those operations, whereas that has not happened in the United States.
That's correct. In the U.S., it has primarily been supported by Department of Defense grants, institutions, and at NYU, one of the key elements is that our institution is providing this grant support for these individuals. since I came in November 1st of last year. It will give us a little bit of time to get our program going. We're currently ready to start moving forward. We've been organizing our teams. The amount of structural and infrastructural support that I have now at NYU far surpasses what I had when I was in Baltimore. And our institution and our dean and CEO, Bob Grossman, has 100% commitment for us to be a lead center caring for not only civilians and wounded warriors, but potentially first responders and our servicemen and women in every capacity, ensure that they receive the best care possible. And that's why NYU is supporting this program.
Where do you see facial transplantation in the future? I don't know, 10, 20, 50 years from now.
I'm probably going to compare it most to liver transplantation. We keep in mind, liver transplantation began in the 1960s. The first several patients all died. There was no survivor from these operations at the beginning. And if you look at liver transplantation today, it's mainstream. I would see facial transplantation become mainstream. But I think the most important thing, as you mentioned, in Europe, it's part of the national health system, which is good and bad. I think it can offer these procedures to a number of individuals. However, we really want to make sure that this is a procedure which is offered to only select individuals with a specific anatomical deformity defined by individuals with expertise and in an environment that can support these patients long term. So I would probably see centers or a small number of centers within the U.S. that have the capacity and infrastructure to provide this level of care, and certainly NYU will be one of those centers providing this level of care. But more importantly, we have such expertise from a surgical standpoint, from a reconstructive standpoint, that we can define there are large numbers of patients that will not need this type of surgical procedure. What they need is state-of-the-art type of facial reconstruction that we can easily provide.
I think this
will become mainstream.
Do you see this kind of facial transplantation becoming available to a wide range of people in the future? I mean, children, for instance, who've had very disfigured faces?
That's a great question. As a matter of fact, we're currently in the process of looking at this closely. And I would say that I look at this with caution. At our institution, we've had a center of craniofacial surgery that's dealt with children with congenital deformities since the beginning of our Department of Plastic Surgery. And we look at a number of children. There obviously are some children that we can improve and some that, despite all the best efforts, we can't. But we have to be careful with children. And the reason for that, it's a challenging informed consent process. Parents obviously want what's best for the children, but keep in mind, once you do a face transplant on a child, they have to be on medication for life. And I get very concerned about the child that hits the adolescent years, and we know what our adolescent life was like. There's always a level of rebelliousness, a level of noncompliance. So we want to make sure that this is provided for these individuals. I wouldn't say that we wouldn't do it, but we need to look at those individuals carefully, plug them into a system that can support the families, that can support the children, so that when they reach a timeline in their life where they understand the consent process entirely and what this endeavor means, that we can go ahead and move forward with a face transplant on a younger individual.
Coming back to Richard, does he look much like he did before he had his accident? I mean, he's a lot older now, of course, but do you see a resemblance there?
You know, I'm biased because I was a surgeon that did this, but I'm going to say he looks better. When you and I will say he always carried a high school graduation picture of himself. And when you look at a photograph of him, which we took, he gave such a remarkable speech at a Gift of Life gala where we honored the family that not only donated his face, but donated all the other organs, and all these family members were there. And I took a photograph of Richard in his tuxedo. In his high school graduation picture, he was wearing a black tuxedo with a red tie. And the photograph that I have of him in his Gift of Life gala celebration, black tuxedo with a black tie and his hair is combed back, he looks like a movie star. He looks remarkable. He really does. And I think he looks like an appropriately mature, handsome version of his high school graduation picture. But he looks very remarkable. And obviously, my disclosure is that I'm biased, but he looks remarkable.
So given your kind of firsthand sort of observation of all of this, I mean, what do you conclude about the connection between personal appearance and identity? I mean, do they go kind of hand in hand?
It's a great question. So initially, and I think still to today, lay people, and including a lot of ourselves, we tend to wonder, what's a patient with severe facial disfigurement going to think when he or she receives a new face? It's not what you and I think. Because when these patients with severe disfigurement look in the mirror, they do not see normalcy. They do not see that individual who looked like before the injury. So all these issues, all these concerns, all these potential identity crises that we thought would arise haven't been the case. We've not seen this in 30 patients. What we've seen is that patients actually improve and feel that they're normal and they can interact and become productive members of society. So the identity crises that we all perceived have not been the case. And when patients look in the mirror, when they have a normal face, and I could only speak about Richard's case, when he looks in the mirror and even his family tells him, it's Richard. It looks like Richard, an older version of Richard, and it's what they see. And I think they've blocked out the disfigurement or facial difference that they carried for so many years because they probably reflected on the time that that person looked normal. And then when they see normal anatomical features, eyelids, nose, lips, things that we define as normal in the face, we once again accept the individual as he was before the injury. So, and that's how patients see it. And that took me a while to figure that out. But that's exactly how Richard sees himself.
But it also, it sounds like in some ways people are not as bound to their personal appearance as we might have thought. I mean, as what makes up their core identity. I mean, obviously they don't want to look weird, but if they look normal or, you know, pretty good, but even different, that's fine. I mean, they can construct a new identity at that point.
Correct. They just want to look average. What people want with disfigurement, they want to blend in. They don't want people staring at them and wanting to question what happened. They just want to blend in like everyone else. And that's why the face is so important, because it's the only part of your body you can't really conceal. You can conceal other disfigurements or deformities within your body and you can cover it up with clothes, but the face is the one area that was not meant to be covered up in our society, and people want to know why it is. But once these patients feel normal, look normal, can go to a restaurant and eat without anybody staring at them, that's all they want to achieve. They just want to blend in.
This truly is an amazing story. Thank you so much for coming in to talk about it.
You're welcome. My pleasure.